This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is the city's largest union of municipal employees. We're part of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We're on Sunday nights at 8 p.m., and then we rebroadcast on Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. This evening, we're talking with noted investigative journalist in residence at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, Tom Robbins. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, Chris.
On Thursday, January 19th, veteran investigative reporter Wayne Barrett passed away at the age of 71. Barrett made a name for himself for his work at the Village Voice for 37 years, writing about corruption in city government, prominent elected officials such as former mayors Ed Koch and Rudy Giuliani, and our new president, Donald Trump. This evening, we'll be talking about Wayne Barrett, his life and career. Sir, you are one of Mr. Barrett's closest colleagues and friends. What was the impact of Wayne Barrett on the life of New York City?
I think it was huge in many ways. Wayne, I think, was the foremost muckraker in the last two decades, at least, in New York City. He was known for the guy who found out after all of the press corps of New York thought they had combed all through Rudy Giuliani's life. Wayne's the guy who found out that Giuliani, the man who prosecuted the mafia, actually had mafia relatives, and his father had done time for armed robbery in Sing Sing. Wayne was the very first reporter to realize that this young, brash developer from Queens with the crazy hairdo who was just coming into the city in the late 70s was a con man and someone to keep an eye on and grist for the mill of investigative reporter. And he wrote a great book about Trump that came out in 1992, which was now reissued because the demand was so huge over the last 18 months. So Wayne's impact on all kinds of levels, I think, was immense.
You say he's the last of the muckrakers. I mean, I would include there are some of us still around, not some of us, some of you still around. But the world has changed in terms of how muckraking reporting gets reported, but what the forums are for that. I mean, he spent 37. The Village Voice was a potent force in New York City journalism for many years, and there really isn't. I was thinking about this the other day. Through Barrett, through yourself, through Newfield, you found out in the Village Voice the lives of neighborhoods from the political side of things. Who runs, Crown Heights, and how are the connections between what's happening in Crown Heights, the rest of Brooklyn, blah, blah. And I don't think that that exists anymore, or there's a forum for that anymore. Is that true?
You know, Wayne said that he stayed at the Voice all those years because of the fact that he knew it was the one place that would let him write what he wanted to write, that the ability to decide on his stories, to spend the time digging on it, was precious to him. And he knew exactly what was going on in other media, and he knew that, he could probably trade up to a higher profile media outlet, but he would never get the free rein that he had in The Voice. And I look, in his glory years, I think The Voice was exactly what you're talking about. It was one-stop shopping to find out what was going on in New York City government, what was going on in terms of issues of poverty and race on a lot of different levels. And Wayne's demise at The Voice, he was laid off in the end of 2010 by the then owners who actually lived in Phoenix, Arizona, and didn't ever really comprehend how much Wayne meant to New Yorkers. I think that was one of the things that really hurt the institution.
You knew, and you quit after Wayne was. I mean, that was famous. I mean, you and Wayne were the Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid of investigative reporters at the Village Voice. And when Butch went, the Sundance Kid went with them, right?
I thought when they were saying we don't need Wayne Barrett anymore, they were making a statement about we don't need the gold standard of investigative reporting anymore. And my sense was, well, you don't need him. You don't need me. I'm not going to dignify your pages with my stuff if you don't really have room for him anymore. So that was not a hard decision.
I was thinking about this when I was communications director at the city council. Wayne called me up one day. I don't even remember what the story was about. But clearly it was about something that had happened at the city council or someone, maybe in the speaker's office, where something was up and he was looking into it. And he said, and he laid out what it was. But what I remember was he said, this is the most outrageous thing. And I thought to myself, I'm talking to Wayne Barrett, who's seen a lot of outrageous things. But his indignation, and I thought to myself, this is what makes him a great, the ability to be outraged, no matter what you've seen over years, instead of dulling the senses, his sense of what was wrong and his ability to feel that way was one of the key things that made him a great reporter.
I think you said it exactly right, Chris. I think that's really the difference between the kind of often antiseptic way in which, you know, people who are schooled in the trade of journalism come at their stories sometimes. Wayne, his anger and his rage sometimes led him in the wrong direction.
Right.
I mean, I think that sometimes I'm on a union show here, and I think that on some level, Wayne, who, by the way, was a child of the South, he grew up in Lynchburg, Virginia, Jerry Falwell territory. He didn't know from unions. When he came to New York, his first brush with unions was the Ocean Hill-Brownsville school strike, and Wayne was a teacher there. Wayne passionately believed in the right of, you know, trying to rectify, you know, how bad the schools were and doing something about it on a community level, and that colored his attitude about it. So he and I would argue constantly. I don't think he ever got solid. But in terms of passion and outrage, I mean, I don't think that there was ever a reporter who brought as much, you know, true insight as a result of his outrage. A lot of us get mad about things. But Wayne, his father was a nuclear physicist. He had, you know, the heart of a lion and the head of a computer, as Mark Green tweeted shortly after his death. And that's what made his reporting really different.
Let's slow down a bit about how Wayne got to be Wayne, because you just said he came from the South. What was his background? I mean, take it slower in terms of telling us his story.
Sure. Glad to do it.
Okay.
You know, Wayne was born at the end of World War II, 1945. He was raised in Lynchburg, and he attended Catholic schools. And I believe that the lessons that he learned in those Catholic schools are one of the things that sort of helped him come to his understanding of the kind of righteous indignation that you're talking about. He took seriously all the lessons he got. One time, Wayne thought about becoming a priest. He went to this. He famously told a New York Times reporter why he decided not to do it. I'm not going to do that on your radio show.
Oh.
Wayne had no filter when people asked him questions, and he lived forever with that.
Okay. Well, maybe it had something to do with girls?
Somewhat. Yes.
Somewhat. So how did he come to journalism? How did he come to the Village Voice, and how did he come to start writing about politics?
He went to Columbia Journalism School. He graduated in 1968. He had gone, by the way, to St. Joseph's College in Philadelphia on a scholarship that he got because he was a national debating champion, something anyone who ever had an argument with Wayne would appreciate. And when he got out of journalism school, he moved to Brownsville, Brooklyn, with his wife, Fran. And he worked for a while on the staff of Major Owens. And he first began digging into the machinations of the local poverty barons at that time. Sam Wright, who was then the councilman from Brownsville, was a guy who I think sort of became for Wayne the white whale of like trying to understand how people rip off the system for their benefit in the midst of the poorest neighborhoods. Wayne wrote his first stories for The Voice about Sam Wright, who later went to jail, based partially on the reporting that Wayne did.
And Rudy Giuliani was originally kind of a hero to Wayne Barrett in terms of prosecuting his zealous prosecution of bad guys. I mean, one of the books that is the book on every desk at the City Hall press room when I worked there. There were two books. There's Caro's The Power Broker, and there's Newfield and Barrett, City for Sale. And that book, if I've got my memory right on this, Rudy Giuliani plays a major role in that book.
He's the hero.
He's the hero of that book. And I'm not even sure what the question is I want to ask.
Oh, no,
that.
I think I get the question, Chris. If I always take a crack at it, anyways. Look, I think it is sometimes easy to see the world in black and white, and Wayne saw Rudy Giuliani rightfully at that point in Giuliani's career when he was the United States Attorney in Manhattan as the man who was unafraid to take down wrongdoers. He went after Stanley Friedman. He went after the entire cabal of politically connected people that had snuck into the Koch administration. And Jack Newfield and Wayne Barrett, I think, both thought that Rudy Giuliani was someone who could do well by the city. That attitude changed a great deal when Giuliani became mayor. And Wayne saw that this was a guy who really was emphasizing his race as a white guy who was going to take over the city from what he called a failed black mayor, David Dinkins, at the time. And Wayne spotted him at the time, argued with him, and later became his fiercest critic, wrote not one but two books about Rudy Giuliani trying to correct what he wrote in City for Sale.
Well, there you go. Giuliani, was it blind ambition, or was there a belief system in place? I've never really quite been able to make a conclusion about what was driving Rudy at that time.
Well, whatever it was, you know, it's finally driven him crazy.
Yeah, that's
watched
true.
Him over the past summer dealing, you know, as one of the Trump spokespersons, you know. But look, ambition is something that I think, you know, perverts a lot of great people. I've seen people who I truly admired. I mean, the politicians who, like, once they really got a taste of some power, started saying and doing things which I was appalled by. And I think Rudy Giuliani took that to another level, that he recognized that if he was going to be a success in politics, he needed to go to the right. You know, when we first met him, he was a women's right to choose advocate fiercely. He was a defender of gay rights. I mean, this is a man who lived with a gay couple
right.
when he left his wife. And all of those things he abandoned once it became when he started running in national politics.
I remember actually making some news by asking him covered City Hall, and he was the mayor. Colin Powell was thinking about there was noise about Colin Powell mm-hmm. running for president. And I asked him whether or not he thought Colin Powell should run. And at first he ducked the question. And then I said, but should he run as a Republican? Because it wasn't clear what Colin Powell was at that time, Democrat, Republican. There was some question about that. And he went into this long, impassioned riff on how he should absolutely run as a Republican and that the Republican Party, you know, that he, Colin Powell, Bill Weld were the last, needed to be the bastion of mm-hmm. moderate Republicanism.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, at the time you talk to a guy and you hear him and the passion with which he was talking about the need for moderate conservatism. And now I think about this past summer and you just... politics is a strange world, and I don't think it even served him very well. We're still waiting for the position. If he gets nominated to the Supreme Court, I'm going to throw it all.
You know, one of my favorite Wayne stories about Rudy, he wrote two books, but there was a point, I think, after those two books, when Wayne learned that Giuliani had managed to get four Yankees World Series rings at a cut-rate price.
Oh, boy.
Everybody knows that Giuliani was this terrific Yankees fan yes. who always loved to sit in the front row next to the dugout there. But he always insisted that, like, there was no contradiction in terms of being mayor. And Wayne found out that which was clearly illegal.
Right.
I mean, you were supposed to disclose, you know, we're talking about the emoluments clause, you
right,
know.
Right,
this
right.
was a guy getting something of enormous value every time. And he was cutting in line to get these rings. And I think for Wayne, who, by the way, was a fierce Red Sox fan, you know, for him that was like the final nail in the coffin.
We're talking with Tom Robbins about Wayne Barrett. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union. I'm Chris Policano. This is the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE. We're talking with Tom Robbins, who is investigative journalist in residence at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. We're talking about the life and career of Wayne Barrett, who passed away a couple of weeks ago at the age of 71 after a long career writing about New York City politics, really about the life of New York City. One of the things that Wayne Barrett was, you know, very, very famous for in a certain group of among a certain group of people was that he had a I don't know what you even want. I don't want to call them a stable, but he had a stable of interns who went on to become noted journalists in their own right over his time at the Village Voice. And he was a notorious educator of the craft. Talk a little bit about that, if you will, and some of the folks who came out of that.
About Wayne's journalism that was both defined him and also was completely different from the way most journalists work. I mean, lots of people have one or two research assistants. Wayne would often have as many as half a dozen interns working for him at the same time at the Village Voice. And it was a kind of boot camp for would-be reporters, and Wayne was the fierce taskmaster. And despite the fact that he would growl and bark and scold them, if you want to get a sense of, like, what it means to have someone as a mentor, just take a look around at the web at some of the reminiscences that people have offered, everyone from Matt Taibbi to Tim O'Brien to Jennifer Gonderman, about the impact that Wayne had on their lives. Wayne's watchword was once an intern, always an intern. You know, you never left. You signed up for life. And so he really meant it. And
I know reporters who say, you know, Wayne called me up the other day, gave me an assignment. I said, Wayne, I'm doing 14 other things. He said, this is what you should be looking at.
One of our friends who was not Wayne's intern, but who was a pretty well-known public relations person and told me a story just after Wayne's passing about how he had come home one night and heard a message on his home message machine with Barrett saying, Ken Friedman, where the F are you? And Friedman thought to himself, who does this guy think he is? I don't work for him. And then he said, yeah, actually, I guess I do work
for
him.
That's right.
And he went out and got the information.
He was working until he wasn't able to. I mean, the Trump presidency, as clear, his knowledge of Trump made him a very valuable commodity to other journalists who tapped his brain and went through his files, and he was still working until he wasn't able to physically.
Truly. I mean, had a conversation with him 2 weeks before he died, in which he told me about the story he was working on and what he had found out. It was a Trump-related piece of information. And I just thought, how did you figure that out from your sickbed? You know, you're lying there in Windsor Terrace, Brooklyn, and you're not getting out of bed, and you're out reporting most of the journalists in America. And his son Mac and his wife Fran and Mac's girlfriend Sheila June told me about how when they drove him to the hospital, he was on the phone interviewing a source for that story.
Unbelievable. On the way to the hospital.
On the way to the hospital.
He went to Columbia Journalism School do you think that the value, I'm trying to get at, with young journalists, the internship probably was 6 journalism degrees worth mm-hmm. of information and knowledge. How long did he spend with these young reporters? Did they go on for one semester?
Yeah, sometimes it was a semester. Sometimes it was like be a 2 or 3 month thing. Sometimes it would be longer. Some people came. I mean, Wayne had interns who were, some of them were retired people. People who had just been longtime readers of his, who admirers, who wanted to do something new, who said, would you take me on as an intern? I'll do whatever I can do. You know, people wanted to learn, and they knew that they could learn so much from Wayne. And, you know, I think that, you know, you won't know how many of them are just by reading their bylines, but the number of people out there who did time as Barrett interns is phenomenal, and how successful they've been in their own fields.
You've got a piece in the I saw a piece online for the Columbia Journalism Review, a reminiscence. Your own sense of have you gotten your head around the fact that Wayne is gone, or do you still feel the urge to like sort of, you know, pick up the phone, talk? I mean, I just
No, that doesn't go away for a long time. I guess, you know. I mean, Wayne used to famously start the day by calling me and probably half a dozen others and saying, you probably don't know what you're going to do today until you talk to me.
Breslin used to do that, right? I mean, Breslin would call people at 6 in the morning or something.
Breslin was one of his early callers, one of my early callers. I don't know how the guy ever got anything done. He was always calling. but yeah, no, that was something that Wayne loved to do, was to, like, you know, have these early morning gab fests. But they were always, you know, it's funny, like, if you ever ran into the great Murray Kempton in the course of doing his, you know, workaday job, he would start talking to you, and you would realize as he was talking his column, and he was trying it out on you and giving you lines. And Wayne would do somewhat the same thing. I mean, he wasn't the kind of craftsman that Murray was when it came to words, but Wayne wanted to sort of get a reality check from you about what he was finding. And so, you know, I mean, I had to always be very careful about what I told Wayne about what I was working on, not because he would steal it. He would never do that. He was an incredibly honorable person. But he was a blabbermouth, you know, and he would forget what he was supposed to keep secret and what he wasn't. But, you know, Wayne, and he would admit that about himself. I'm not saying something that he didn't acknowledge himself, but he worked so much and so hard, as I wrote in that piece, I think, or one of the pieces I did about him. This is a guy whose day idea of a good time was a day at the beach reading campaign filings.
Right.
You know, he literally would do that.
And do you think that, seriously, I think we get these romantic notions of the folks in the journalism world of our times, so that we think fondly of folks like Wayne and Breslin and Hamill and Newfield, and names of people who have really written about New York City over a period of time. And is there a next generation? I don't want to wax too poetic about all this, but the sense that there is always the sense that the folks that you're with are the best folks there ever were.
Yeah. That's our own, you know, attitude. I mean, look, a lot of them are these interns, you know. I mean, Jesse Drucker.
Right.
Who now works at the New York Times and who's been one of the greatest reporters on the issue of tax evasion by major corporations over the last few years, previously for Bloomberg and now for the Times, attitude. I mean, look, Bill Bastone, who founded thesmokinggun.com and who wrote some of the toughest pieces about Trump over the past year, with he and Wayne were sort of like comparing notes the whole time. Jennifer Gonerman, who's now at the New Yorker and whose work on people who've been incarcerated and the interplay between that and politics has been nothing short of magnificent. The woman who wrote the story of Kalief Browder and how he died after being locked up in solitary for so long in Rikers.
I never refer to Jennifer Gonerman without saying, you know, I always call it the great Jennifer Gonerman.
Great Jennifer Gonerman.
And she is. I mean, the work that she has kept this remarkable sense of intelligence and doggedness through this issue of criminal justice, and I think that her work has been,
I think she'd say that, like, you know, look, she didn't know anything about this stuff before she started as a Barrett intern back in the late 90s, and she'll tell you that, you know, that was her education. So, you know, the inheritors are many. You know, I mean, Wayne was a huge admirer, as am I, of Jim Dwyer. Right. The Times columnist. And, you know, but yet you look around And now that Juan Gonzalez is gone from the Daily News, Jim's kind of the last man standing in that tradition of the, you know, great, you know, Michael Daly's still doing it for the Daily Beast, you know, but like that was always an outlet for the tough stories about the city, about inequities, about, you know, people who had a chance to be able to really get really great stories out. We don't have that many of them around. So we need some new moves to the basket, you know, put it that way. We really do. And I think that, you know, the coming era is one that's going to give people the spark to do it.
We were talking about this before we went on air, and the irony that Wayne Barrett will not live a minute under President Trump. You know, you think that's a great act of defiance in some ways. I'm not staying here for a minute of President Trump. But you think, you know, how great would it be to have him at the top of his game watching this?
You know, I was thinking on the train on the way to the studio about another great columnist who's not so well-remembered anymore, Lars Eric Nelson.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And Lars was this great columnist for the Daily News and for Newsday at one point. And in a similar situation after the election of 2000, when the great national debate over counting votes in Florida, Lars literally wrote his heart out and collapsed of a heart attack just before the Supreme Court decision. And I remember thinking, you know, Lars was such a magnificent writer and such a great thinker. That's a voice which will not be replaced. And I was realizing, you know, Wayne's not just his knowledge. I mean, he knew everything about Trump, but I think his understanding about how Trump operated is something that's, you know, we're going to miss greatly.
You know, before we go, I wanted to give you a couple of minutes to talk about something that you've been very much involved with and writing about, and the story of your friend Judith Clark. I don't even want to introduce it. I just want to give you time to say whatever you want to say. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left, and this is something that and what Governor Cuomo did at the end of the year. Right. So why don't you just tell us?
No, I'll give you the Wayne Barrett story just because Judith Clark was someone I wrote about for the Times Magazine back in 2012 because of the fact that she was the one person from that band of crazed rebels of the Weather Underground, et cetera, who took part in some terrible crimes. And Judy's was one of the worst. She was involved in the Brinks robbery as a getaway driver back in 1981. That left 2 brave cops dead and a Brinks guard also shot to death. And I wanted nothing to do with her for over 25 years, but I finally went up to Bedford Hills Prison and came to re-know her and recognize that this was a woman who was truly trying to struggle with trying to make right as best she could what she had done and to remake her life. And the effort to she was given a sentence at conviction of 75 years to life, which would have meant that she didn't get out until she was 106 years old. And there was a lot of people who wanted her to get clemency. And Andrew Cuomo actually went to Bedford Hills, met with Judy Clark, and gave her clemency on New Year's Eve. And Wayne, one of the last things he did was to go up to Cuomo's party opening the Second Avenue subway. And he thanked Cuomo for doing what he said was one of his finest acts of his governorship, to give clemency to Judy Clark, and he told him it was something his father, Mario Cuomo, would have been proud of. And then the governor gave him a big, wet kiss on the cheek, and later, when he came down with pneumonia, he delighted in teasing Cuomo when he called him at the hospital to say, you know, I think you gave me that kiss of death there. It wasn't true.
That is all the time we have this week. Tom Robbins, thank you very much for talking with us about the life of Wayne Barrett. Until next time, folks, I'm Chris Policano. My engineer is Andrea Minocchio. Rudy Orozco is the producer. Till next time, ciao.